everything, but her favorite food was fries and eggs. Yeah.
Fries?
Yeah.
Fries are the ones that win?
Yeah. She liked the most. Yes.
Out of all the amazing Afghan rice and meat and kebabs, she likes fries?
Yes. Yeah, that's what she likes.
Her mom puts on a brave face, but you can see she's in pain. It was Jamila, this mother, who sealed her daughter's fate. She took Marwa's name off that Canadian visa list. She says she only did it to save her son from the Taliban. That's because her son, Marwa's brother, worked for the Canadian Army. She knew she had to get him out of harm's way.
Yeah, and I wanted my son to be in a safe place.
That's Marwa's youngest sister, translating.
I had like two sons before, but one of them got killed in Afghanistan, so I was scared for my other son.
Scared because the son that was killed by the Taliban years before. Jamila wasn't willing to put the life of her second son at risk. Put yourself in Jamila's shoes. What would you do?
It sounds like a heartbreaking choice because you're a mother and you want to protect your son and you want to also protect your daughter.
That was like lots of stress and like her brain was not working. But she had to leave her because maybe they will tell the Taliban that her son was working with the Canadian Army. So she was scared about that. So she had to leave her daughter.
Did you ever think that Marwa's life would turn out the way that it has?
She have never think that way because she thought she will join a new family and that will be her home and she will get married and be happy.
Do you regret, you know, taking Marwa's name off that list?
So when I'm taking her name, like, or I hear her name, I think like I'm dying. And then it was so hard to take her name out of that list.
It's hard. I see the tears, Jamila. I can't even fathom what it's like to be a mother in this situation.
So I don't even know when is the day and when is the night. Like, it's so hard for me to think about her, and she's in a country where she doesn't belong to be. Like, it's not a country which is safe for her, but she's still there and I'm really scared.
Marwa's case stands out because how many people in that desperate time turned down a Canadian visa? Back in Pakistan, a call from her mother, Jamila, interrupts our interview. This is the call Marwa longs for every day. We part ways so she can have some privacy. As we walk away from this shoebox apartment, Riley and I can't get this young woman off our minds.
I feel like both of us are just like exhausted from just hearing like the pain and what she's gone through. I would say in 15 years, there are 3 times in my career that I can't hold back the tears.
We're sitting here, both of us, trying to hold back the tears right now. And you just can't dream up a situation that is as terrible as hers.
She's 20 years old. She's a baby.
Like, when I was 20 years old, I was in third year university, just starting my life, I knew very little about the world. And this woman, this girl, is divorced, abandoned, and living on her own in an area of the world where women are not independent and living on their own.
It's like all the choices in her life have been taken away from her. It is like horrific to listen to.
Coming up on our final episode of Dear Taliban.
Imutermas. This is our car?
Yep.
This is us.
Yep.
That's Haya getting into the car. If you've forgotten who she is, I'll remind you. She's been our guide and translator today. But there's something else I should tell you about her. A secret I've been keeping from you until now.
You had to memorize this?
Yeah, I had to memorize this.
How old were you here?
Like 12, 13 perhaps?
No teleprompters?
No.
That secret? Haya can't walk down the street without being recognized. She is famous. In our final episode, we find out why and what that fame has cost her.
That's your Canada Land. You can email Jesse at jesse@canadaland.com. He really does read them all. Our website is canadaland.com. Molly Thomas reported this episode. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capacchione. I'm the editor-in-chief, Karen Pugliese. And our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Hi, this is Emilie Nicolas, your guest host for Shortcuts this week, and I am joined by veteran political journalist Paul Wells. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Salut, Emilie.
This week, we're going to be discussing the calls for Trudeau's resignation, but in an international context of basically the G7 countries imploding. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Justin Trudeau and Joe Biden, two leaders, both under pressure, both facing questions about their political future.
Tonight, questions of leadership, calls for change on both sides of the border.
In the past week, the news in North America have been filled with calls for resignation, both for Joe Biden, who we'll discuss in the second half of the show, stay tuned, but also for Justin Trudeau. Once a media darling, Trudeau isn't doing much talking now following a stunning by-election loss in the Toronto St. Paul Liberal stronghold last week. Here's what the last week has sounded like for Justin Trudeau.
Well, this morning's news headlines did not paint a good picture for the future of Prime Minister Trudeau.
Hello, everyone. Happy Canada Day.
But whatever the Conservatives are doing, it worked Monday in the former Liberal stronghold of Toronto St. Paul's.
No matter where you are, I hope you're celebrating the incredible people, the land, and the story that is Canada.
But we're going to start on that email from a Liberal MP to caucus calling for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to resign.
It's a story of sacrifice.
Politicians past and present saying Justin Trudeau needs to go.
Safeguarded every day by trailblazers, journalists, activists, organizers.
This freelance columnist for the Toronto Star says he overheard Trudeau's environment minister making phone calls to Liberals while waiting for a train.
Where we can disagree, sometimes passionately.
And 4 days later, Trudeau still has not taken a single question from a reporter about that conservative triumph.
But where we always come together in the pursuit of something greater than ourselves.
Justin Trudeau says he is committed to staying on as Prime Minister.
Brave, kind, resilient people. That is the story of Canada. Happy Canada Day.
Newspaper headlines have told a similar story about Justin Trudeau. Obviously, the Toronto and the Ottawa ones. The one article that stood out was by Justin Ling in the Toronto Star, who wrote a piece called Liberals Are Revolting Against Justin Trudeau. I heard it myself, overhearing essentially Stephen Guilbeau in the Toronto ViRail Business Lounge having a conversation with different Liberals MP. And obviously, you saw the piece, Paul?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was laughing from the headline on down.
Is that what you have? Is that what the main sentiment is? Laughter?
First of all, congratulations to Justin Ling. That has to be the first interesting thing that's ever happened in the Toronto Via One Lounge. I'm familiar with that room and nothing happens. Secondly, people are astonished that Stephen Guilbeau would not recognize a journalist sitting next to him. But Justin is a freelancer. He's not based in Ottawa anymore.
Yeah, he's low-key, yeah.
All of the members of cabinet have staffs to keep a certain distance between them and the other members of the sort of Ottawa bubble. I believe Stephen Guilbeau would recognize me, but I wouldn't guarantee it. So people shouldn't be so harsh on Guilbeau. The final thing is that it's just astonishing that you would send Stephen Guilbeau to Toronto to shore up support for Justin Trudeau. Those members of the party who think that Trudeau is a problem, and it's not clear how many Liberals believe that, those who do probably think that their climate policy and its champion, Stephen Guilbeau, is part of the problem. And to say the least, he doesn't have an awful lot of Toronto chops. He's not a long-time career politician. His career in climate activism didn't take him to Toronto business train lounges very often. It's an odd choice of a political Sherpa for the Save Justin Trudeau leadership project. But then I guess, as Don Rumsfeld once said, you go to war with the army you've got.
That makes sense. To me, I'm going to be honest with you. I've been struggling to get emotionally invested with the Trudeau drama. Part of it is it's been happening exactly at the same time as the U.S. election drama, and we're going to get to that. But it feels like there is this mastodont that is overgoing such a huge crisis right next to us, and it's very hard to have a conversation about Trudeau must go or not, or even if Justin Trudeau is doing well or not, or how he's going to perform in the next election, because all of that, to be honest, could be very much upset by whatever's going on in the U.S., especially if there was a Trump win. That would change, I think, the political conversation in Canada drastically. But overall, I'd say that I'm feeling like the conversation about the Canadian political crisis has been very insular, in a sense that what we are seeing in Canada is a center basically imploding. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen a lot of political journalism in the Toronto newspaper, the Ottawa newspapers, the English Canadian newspaper, putting that into the global context of, you know, what's been going on in Europe as well. And I feel like the French Canadian media are actually the ones doing that job right now of just putting what's happening to Justin Trudeau in conversation with what's happening with Joe Biden, but also what's happening to Emmanuel Macron and what's been happening in European politics as well, with the right rising and the far right rising in a way that's very, very dangerous, and people attacking the fabric of democracy. And, you know, the UK election that has been going over God knows how many prime minister now in the last couple of years, and just like the instability of it all seems to be outside of the scope of the conversation in English media way more than in French Canadian media. And as somebody who also follows both, I was wondering if you also noticed that split in terms of how things are being analyzed?
I have to some extent. I think it has to do with two things. First of all, Francophone media in Quebec are to some extent wired into Europe more than Anglophone media in the rest of Canada are, because news sources from France provide a good chunk of the news diet in Quebec.
Mm.
Secondly, just about every news organization in Canada right now is a downtown news organization for the city that it serves. Its newsroom budgets have collapsed for reasons that we probably don't need to rehearse one more time. Like, the Ottawa Citizen no longer has an editor who is spending half his time writing about Europe the way it did when Keith Spicer was editing the Ottawa Citizen a million years ago. There's basically no room in newsroom budgets for a broader perspective.
Right.
But you're right, there's an interesting perspective. So for instance, the Canadian and British elections are very similar. Well, except that we don't have an election in Canada yet, but the anticipated Canadian election, and also the party stripe of the expected losers.
Mm.
Rishi Sunak is going to be beaten bad in the UK election, which is happening today, as a pro-Brexit Tory, and he's going to be replaced by a boring, moderate Labour leader.
Mm-hmm.
Liberals could only hope for that to happen here. But meanwhile, the Rassemblement National, the National Rally, which is the inheritors of Le Penism in France, are going to win pretty big on Sunday, and they've got a chance of having a majority in the National Assembly. Similar parties now govern in the Netherlands and in Italy, and that's a story that isn't getting a lot of coverage here. Like, I was going to go to Britain and France this week and cover their elections, but I deserve a break too, yeah. So I decided not to. Plus, I'm only one newsletter.
Yes, you are. But what a newsletter you are. Listen, so maybe we dig a little bit deeper into what's been missing so that we're all on the same page here. But even before we go in deeper into what's been going on in France, just at the end of May, the Vox organization in Spain organized a large gathering of the Western far right.
Yeah.
And you had there Marine Le Pen, who, as you mentioned, is the leader of the Rassemblement National, the far right in France. Viktor Orban, who is leading Hungary, a dictator now at this point. Giorgia Meloni, who's the prime minister in Italy, also associated with the far right. You had Javier Milei, who is the president of Argentina and who is making Donald Trump look moderate in terms of his discourse. And so you have all of those people essentially consulting each other and creating an international global movement where one of those people winning is giving essentially fuel to the next person winning. There's also the rise of those same movements in Spain itself and in Portugal. And now in France, what you have is, as you mentioned already, in the last couple of days, you know, you had the first round of the legislative election that was sparked by Emmanuel Macron. And now in the second round, in the last couple of days, people have been strangling to essentially resign, so that basically France is divided between three blocks, the far right, the center, and the left. And when the far right is likely to win, if the center and the left are in the race, either the center or the left has been resigning, so that you have this common front against the far right. And not everybody has been able to do that. And so we'll see what the results will be. But there is this huge fear that France might be governed by a far right party in the next, well, just next week, in terms of at least the legislative power in the National Assembly. And that creates a lot of conversation in Montreal, even about, you know, why is it that the far right is on the rise? What is the connection between that and fears about immigration? What is the connection between that and misinformation, disinformation in the media ecosystem? There's a lot of analysis around that. And then I'm reading about Justin Trudeau and his losing of a by-election and people basically going as vultures for whatever's left of Justin Trudeau. And I'm not seeing people understanding the gravity, is what I would say, the gravity of the political moment we're in, where we're in one of the years or the year where you have the most election globally and the instability of Western, essentially political democracies at this point. And I'm not sure we're taking seriously how unstable our ecosystems are and the G7 allies are right now, and what the consequences might be for us to not have that in mind while we're trying to upset Canada's political, you know, structure as well.
As is often the case when we talk, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yes.
First of all, these right-wing groups are keeping an eye on one another, and they follow each other's successes and failures. There was a fascinating interview that Steve Bannon gave, the Trump acolyte. He spoke to David Brooks in the New York Times last week, and he said, on our show War Room, I probably spend at least 20% of our time talking about international elements in our movement. So we've made Nigel Farage a rock star, Giorgia Meloni a rock star, Marine Le Pen is a rock star, Geert Wilders is a rock star. As often is the case, I think Steve Bannon is taking more credit than he deserves. Like I think the people of the Netherlands made Geert Wilders a rock star, not Steve Bannon, but that's to show that they do talk to each other. I don't always make a lot of friends when I say I think the moderate brokerage center in a lot of these countries has to ask itself some questions about our failures over the last 30 years, which has left a lot of room for radical alternatives to make their case. If I'd gone to France this week, I would have gone to Marseille, city I've never visited, which is, in every one of its electoral districts, a two-way fight between the extreme right and the extreme left. The Macron centrist party has collapsed, even though Macron tried to turn Marseille into a laboratory for his social policies. The people of Marseille said, thanks very much, we're going to go with Mélenchon or Le Pen. The last thing I'll say is in 2018, the last time I interviewed Justin Trudeau, perhaps the last time I'll ever interview him because he hasn't been returning my calls lately, I asked him about democracy being in danger around the world and what could the advocates of a healthier democracy do to counter that tendency. And he took several minutes to demonstrate that he didn't really have an answer to that question.
One of the most powerful and clear-sighted columns I've read in a really long time was actually just published on Tuesday in Le Devoir by Jean-François Nadeau. It's called The Far Right Doesn't Exist, and it's essentially a wink with the fact that everybody both in Quebec and in France and many places around the world who are part of the far right are denying that the far right even exists, that the far right is a thing. They're seeing it as a label that's put on them, but it really doesn't exist. And so people are even fighting about the word far right right now, and the label, there's legal definitions to it, especially in the French system, and so people are arguing over that. And he talks about that European context, that global context in which the far right is rising, and he mentions Pierre Poilievre, and he doesn't say he's the same, but he does say that Pierre Poilievre is benefiting from that global context in the sense that it's lowering the bar to what dignity looks like in politics. And so when there are things that the Conservative Party is doing and saying that is just not fact-based or not the truth, yeah, or just the spite for journalists, or just the level of disdain that is coming now from the House of Commons, you know, questions period, well, before obviously the summer break, all of that is normalized by an international context that we're not even looking at. So he's pointing that out. And he's also saying that the rise of the far right is a symptom of the basically a collapse of systems of political representation where democracy is denied more and more, and where neoliberal policies just encourage everybody to just think for themselves. And in that way, he says the neo-fascists and their partisans are not representing a threat to the system, but they are a product of the system, yep, that has been failing ordinary people for years. And so it's not so much that, for example, Macron is you know, trying to block the far right more than Macron created the far right. And if somebody like Macron wasn't in power, the far right wouldn't be as powerful. And we could do a similar analysis with the Liberals and Justin Trudeau and the Conservatives as well, in the sense that it's because there has been social crises that haven't been solved in Canada that this kind of populist discourse is becoming so much stronger within the Conservative Party, and that it's giving it fuel. And at the same time, it's because there is so much fuel in that Conservative Party that Justin Trudeau is also the way he's doing right now. And so those two kind of work together as a system, and we tend to see them as just pitted against one another, where really there's just two sides of the same coin. And I feel like that's getting very obvious when you look at the European system and the far right globally. You don't see it if you're just looking in the tree and you're not seeing in the forest. And I think very few analysts in Canada are actually looking in the forest.
Who are the analysts who would? Like, who has a mandate to do that? I mean, Doug Saunders in the Globe. Wow, I'm at the end of the list. Like, You know,
that's a problem. That's right. Like, well, Jean-François Nadeau's doing it. There's a couple of people doing it. But like, if the 21st century is going to be about this level of mess, why is it that we're not prioritizing a level of political analysis and commentary that is at that level if the problem is at that level?
Yeah, if you say that we don't have a media that's up to the current challenge, I'm going to say get in line. The more sophisticated, sustained a conversation is, the smaller an audience that it drives these days. And right. I've got hunches about how to address that, but I don't have a ready answer.
What are your hunches?
Basically, do it anyway. People who want to have productive conversations need to start looking for ways to have them that aren't hoping somebody else buys the Montreal Gazette.
Right. There's no messiah like happening. Just do it yourself kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. We are the ones we're waiting for.
Paul, what would you like to duly note this week?
I was just in Montreal covering the Jazz Fest.
Yeah, we miss each other.
One of the nice things about having a newsletter is that I sometimes try my readers' patience and I write what I want to write about instead of only writing about Canadian politics. And the thing that struck me is it is a very strange thing to write about music in a critical way, to try and assess what musicians are doing, because almost no one is doing it anymore. And it's so different from my early days of the Montreal Gazette. At the Gazette, we had five reporters full-time covering the Jazz Festival. Le Devoir had three or four. I met Brian Miles, the current publisher of Le Devoir, when he was covering the Jazz Festival. And any act that came to town could expect four or five reviews in the papers over the next several days, which led to conversation about music and creativity that has basically vanished since then. And then I thought, as I often do, that just means that music in Montreal is one of many news deserts that have popped up all over. I only became aware of the idea of news deserts probably 5 years ago. These are areas of our public life that don't get a lot of coverage. And it's a lot bigger than jazz music in Montreal. Almost no paper in the country has a courthouse reporter anymore who just sits in the courthouse and covers whatever's interesting in our justice system today. That goes all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada. There is no full-time newspaper reporter covering the proceedings of the Supreme Court. There are a couple of reporters who write about the big decisions at the end of the whole process, but these are trials that take years. They are complex matters of legal tactics. They're complex matters of jurisprudence. And as we've just seen in the United States, sometimes they make really important decisions that affect a lot of lives. And amazingly, that's a news desert. My old employer, McLean's, actually tried to get a grant, one of these government grants, to cover local news. And the argument we made was that the Supreme Court of Canada was local news and that we should have a full-time reporter to cover it. Didn't get the grant. But these news deserts are popping up all over. That's what I was thinking about this week.
It's always interesting when we have conversations because you have this long view on the landscape and how it's been changing in a generation. I find it fascinating in terms of the jazz fest and just music in general. I'm seeing a lot of radio interview. I think Radio Canada is doing a really good job there, but it's interesting how you're shifting essentially from arts criticism, which still exists, but it's, you know, freelancer and it's very, very fragile, to a landscape of artists being promoted by media in a way that feels very promotional. And so it's the criticism part of it that's gone. And obviously social media now also play a big role in terms of having the conversation about music, but that is different from critical journalism. Really important conversation. You dearly noted, Paul. Thank you for that, Paul. That's Shortcuts this week. Thanks for joining me. You can email me about it at emily@canadaland.com. And I read, of course, everything that you send. Paul, where can people find you?
I'm at paulwells.substack.com. It is easy to subscribe without paying. And then you can email me by answering anything that you receive from me on the Substack.
Awesome. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Max Collins. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. And visit them online at cfuv.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Burnaby.